Morning, everybody. That's a song I played on the first day of class, and I was thinking that the title and the sentiment of As Tears Go By might be appropriate for the run-up to finals, so you never know. All right, this is the last formal meeting of the class for this semester. There are two class periods left, and the material for Thursday of this week is posted on the website already. It is a video presentation from the television show NYPD Blue, which has been off the air for quite a while, and this episode goes back 25 years. And actually, there's a reason for that. What we have been seeing in the last few years, and what harkens back to the Rodney King story we were talking about early in this segment, on race and policing is every bit and maybe even more relevant than it was when I think the sort of forward-looking NYPD Blue creators put that piece together. It's part of an episode. It's sort of a cut-and-paste job. The video lasts about 20 minutes, and it relates to the perception of and the reality that African-Americans lived with in the company of, in this instance, a New York Police Department and a particular New York Police detective with regard to race. And then there's a thought piece that you can fill out, think about. There isn't any grading or credit connected with this. It's simply a way of adding more insight into the term. Oddly enough, a Tuesday-Thursday class in the spring semester has two more class periods than the same Tuesday-Thursday class in the fall semester. I have no idea why that is. It just is. So we have this video piece on Thursday. Tuesday, a week from today, Chelsea will be here. It's an optional class, of course, to put on a review for the final. And the final exam is a week from Saturday, May 12th, at 1:30 in the afternoon. That is the one and only time the final exam will be offered. So be here if you need or wish to take it. And if not, no problem. So are there any questions on how we're wrapping things up? Everybody clear on what that's about? Okay. Well, the issue of social change, even the way we talk about social change, has changed. It, by definition, is the alteration of culture and society over time. And we nudged into this a little bit when we were talking about population in the earlier part of this segment. The transition from hunting, gathering, horticultural, agrarian, industrial, post-industrial, and certainly now the age of information. And yet, you know, Marx argued in the 1700s that the engine for social change was the tension between the owners of and the workers within the means of production. And logically and conceptually, that is still true. We have people who control the workplace. We have people who control the political environment, the educational environment, the religious environment, the healthcare system. And all the rest of us, if we are not in positions of control, have more or less access and ability to engage it effectively. And that has changed. I'm just processing a couple of incomplete grades, and the advent of new technology to do that has changed the rules somewhat, and it's thrown me a little bit of a curveball just today that I'll have to deal with. And you know, I understand it, and I can adapt to it. I just didn't see it coming, so the next time I get that curveball, I will hit it. But that's happening to us all the time, and it largely has to do with the ever-increasing computerization of our world. Now, Weber argued that religion was in play and prestige was in play, and he just added a couple of dimensions to that. But the more things change, the more they stay the same. It is still, to varying degrees, a struggle or a cakewalk to access, engage, use, grow from, and thrive within our social world. I listed up here social change and technology, the car, the computer, and the telephone. They have essentially all morphed into one thing, more or less. And social media should be added to that as another example of changing technology. The depersonalization of customer service is on play here with regard to the increasing complexity, I should say, of the computer. But let's talk about the car for a minute. My grandmother was born in 1905, and the automobile was just starting to come into play. We started to have farm-to-market roads being built so that farmers could, on motorized contraptions, take their goods from, you know, the silo, the field, the milk tank. And we still have roads that keep that designation, FM 1585, which I think is actually now 130th Street or something like that. But that is Farm to Market Road number 1585. It's south of town. Used to be the way Baptists would buy booze, because that went out to the Strip, which doesn't exist anymore. It's kind of the back way out of town, but never mind. But there are little remnants of what happened to our world when the car became the way we got from here to there. Drive-through windows. Banks were among the first to have this. Now, you know, most every place, most restaurants that sell all day long have drive-through windows. We can do a lot of things from our car. I alluded to one issue when I was talking about urban legends, you know, the hook urban legend, and the fact that as cars became more universally a part of family life, they became also places where, you know, to put it sort of bluntly, families grew, or at least started to grow, in back seats, etc., you know. And my favorite way of sort of illustrating it, it changed courtship practices, it changed sexual mores and all of this. Now, I was having a conversation, this now goes back 20 years ago, with a parishioner whose daughter turned 16. And he came to me, you know, tongue-in-cheek, "Well, Reverend, I need some advice on the car I want to give so-and-so for his 16th birthday." "A new car?" I said. "Yeah, brand new." "You are dad of the year. Who got the keys to a brand new car on their 16th birthday?" "Yeah. Mom and dad of the year too, right? I mean, hey, that's cool." So he said, "Well, I'm sort of thinking about a Toyota Camry, you know, seemingly reliable, somewhat solid, fairly safe." 16-year-old girl. I said, "Are you nuts? Get her a Mazda Miata." And he said, "Are you nuts?" I said, "No. No back seat." "Oh," he goes. He got her the Camry. It worked out fine. But you get the idea. And I was being facetious as well. So the car now is also morphed into a computerized gadget. One of the things I was proudest of learning how to do in high school was to adjust the timing mechanism in the ignition points in a mechanical carbureted engine. Well, we don't have those anymore. Nobody knows how to adjust the points. Nobody knows what a timing light is. And all of that's done by a computer. And now, a mechanic, the first thing he or she will do when you bring your car in and, you know, a light goes on or something starts rattling, is they'll plug the laptop in and do a diagnostic on that. And that's like walking into an emergency room. The clock, you know, the meter starts ticking at $500. You know, I don't know what that diagnostic costs, but it's not cheap. The whole notion of what a car is, what it can do. I'm about to trade in a car, and I am kind of excited about learning what, since 2012, they have put into the information console, you know, right up front. I mean, it used to have just a GPS, and you could get satellite radio and all that. I'm guessing that I can get everything off the console of my car that I can currently get out of my iPhone, right? More or less? Do they have Wi-Fi in new cars now?
They do.
Yeah? So, sweet. Another different, you know, all new, why did you crack up the car? I was just checking Facebook, you know? It's right there. Can you do that? Can you bring up Facebook on your car console?
I think it'd be pretty complicated.
That would be complicated to do? Good thing, right? Because none of us would know where we were going. Certainly the computer and the telephone have morphed. I had a wonderful conversation with a woman who was a teletype operator during World War II, and long gone on to her reward. And that was sort of the first way of intercontinental communication. I mean, there was long-distance telephone calls and international calling and so on. But mostly the telephone was something that you had to connect literally with wires, and wires went from your house underground someplace up to poles to businesses that literally had wires that connected them to a switchboard, you know. And my grandmother had a job as a switchboard operator, and someone would call in and they'd want to talk to so-and-so, and she'd pick up a cord that had a sort of what looks like an earphone connector to it, only a little bigger, plug it into a switchboard and push a button and that person's phone would ring. Dark ages, you know. But this teletype operator, we were talking about that, and I said, you know, she would have conversations with other teletype operators, just kids in service, essentially, you know, 18, 19, 20-year-olds over there looking for Nazis, right? And they would, you know, send the dots and the dashes that needed to be sent, and then sometimes converse, like, you know, what's happening in Paducah, Kentucky, or Storm Lake, Iowa, wherever they were from. And so I said, well, did you send jokes and stuff? Well, yeah. You know, that was refreshing to me. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Because we're still, you know, sending links to laughing cats or whatever the heck we're doing these days. I don't know. But we're using our telephones and the literal full computerization of our telephone. I do almost all of my travel planning now just with the phone. Airline reservations, tickets to shows, you know, all that kind of stuff. Just click, 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 that's it. And they've morphed into one. And the upshot of this, there's two points I want to make here. One is this almost infinite way of staying connected has what I think is the paradoxical effect of isolating us. Of isolating us. You know, it's not uncommon. You know, last night I came home from a softball game where I was the winning run at the plate with two outs and popped out to second. Son of a... So I was kind of tired and a little depressed. Never mind that I'd already driven in three and scored one, and we only made 10 runs to begin with. So I held up my end, but I'm a little bit, you know, just, I don't want to talk, I don't want to deal with it. You know, I'm tired, kind of sore, long day. And I just sort of looked up, and I don't know quite how we got there, but my wife was in a chair, and I was on the couch, and the TV was on, and we were both like this. That's not interacting. That's not family hour, right? For one thing, the TV's on, and neither one of us are watching it, because we're doing this, and what are we doing? Playing Scrabble with each other. Not making this up. Click, click, click. Your turn. Okay. Click, click, click. Who's with me on this? Who's ever sent a text message to someone who was in the same room with you? Yeah. Who finds it just the least bit off-putting when you're at a lunch with three other people, maybe over in the union or somewhere else, and they are interacting with somebody else? No? That's never happened? And you're not annoyed by it? Okay. This may be overstating it a little bit, but if you are sitting at lunch with another person, having a conversation, and suddenly you're here, and they're going, oh, all right, I'll wait, whatever it is. Oh, must do. There's only one conclusion the other person can draw. Whatever just happened, whatever it is, has drawn your attention away from whatever it is we're talking about. And I have been diminished in importance in this moment. Now, if that person is your TA, who cares? I meant that in a good Christian way. But if it is your wife, or husband, or spouse, or partner, or best friend, and it's your anniversary, leave it at home. Unless you want to send them a text message from across the table like, I'm having the soup. Would you like an appetizer? Click, 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 click.
No.
Click, click, click.
No.
No. That just sounds absurd, doesn't it? Who knows somebody that's done something equally similarly weird with a telephone or whatever the heck, smartphone. Smartphone, dumb people. They've morphed into one, and we are now, I mean, social media is a phrase we didn't know probably 12 years ago. Facebook, I think, first went live in 2004, I think, something like that, 2005. And I tell you what, we haven't caught up. You know, sociologists have as our marching orders to study the interaction patterns and contexts from within human beings connect. And Facebook, for example, has just changed what that means. It's not just how we do it. It changes literally what an interaction is. Now, I'll have to tell you, there's some things that Facebook has enabled me to do that I am really grateful for. You know, I think I've mentioned that digging through my folks' house, I found all these 8mm movies of, you know, my parents before I was born. They're interacting with their siblings, all of whom are gone, and yet who have my cousins and so on. So I found film clips and photographs that I've put up on Facebook for the precise purpose of staying in touch with people. I have several cousins I have not seen personally face-to-face in literally 50 years. Literally. I have an aunt I haven't seen since I was probably 12. And yet, you know, she's on Facebook and she talks to me on the phone once in a while. It's a way of staying connected with people far distant. Now, I have to say, the people in the room with me might get a little bit annoyed if I, you know, the phone goes, oh, Cousin David just sent me a message. He must have seen the picture. Hold on. It'll wait, you know. But it has literally changed what it means to be in the midst of an interaction. You know, the interactionist perspective is the micro point of view that we've been harping about all semester. And what it means to interact has changed through the morphing of certainly the computer and the telephone, to a lesser extent perhaps the car. Although, you know, we have driverless cars now, right? So maybe, you know, going to have to work out a few bugs. But you can go through your whole life running all of the social realities with regard to banking and travel arrangements and food reservations and all that stuff, and never really encounter another human being. You know, it's hard to get somebody on the phone when you call customer service, to get a human voice. It takes a while. And of course, the only reason for that is they have fewer and fewer and fewer people really answering phones. And, you know, I don't know what the royalties they have to pay on the music they play you, but it's probably cheaper than hiring somebody else to answer another extension of the phone. The car, the computer, and the telephone. Architecture, sexual mores, and what it means literally to interact, and how we define literally the word friend. Fair enough? Okay. I want to end my lecture part of the course with a piece of research that was published now roughly 25 years ago that really did change the world. It's called the Support Study. I call it a breezy little piece about death, because that's what it's about. Let me call up the handouts and so on. There's a slideshow that goes with this. And I was lucky enough in 1996 to be at a presentation that was delivered by one of the principal investigators of this study. It's called the Support Study because if you read the first letter of each word and read them down, it says support. Study to understand prognoses and preferences for outcomes and risks of treatment. Published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, 1995. Dr. Joanne Lynn, came to Texas Tech and presented this work to our ethics committees because we were studying, dealing with, and trying to change end-of-life decision-making. That's what this is about, end-of-life decision-making. The study was funded for, and now remember, this is 25 years ago, and actually they were doing the data collection in 1989, 1990. $25 million then, you know, would be substantially more than that now. $25 million to answer one simple question. How and under what conditions does human life end in hospitals? Not just any hospital, but teaching hospitals. You get a lot by just understanding the study. Study to understand. Well, all studies are trying to understand something. This study is trying to understand prognoses. If you go to a doctor and the doctor gives you what he or she calls a prognosis, and the plural of that is prognoses, what are you being given? A prognosis is what? Anybody? Well, my prognosis for you is, what are they going to tell you?
Feedback.
Not, well, maybe feedback, but more it's a summary of what?
The outlook,
yeah. They're telling you essentially what they think is going to happen. Does that make sense? And that'll generate a lot of feedback, so sure. The prognosis is what we think will happen, right? All right. What's a preference? That's kind of what we'd like to have happen, right? And a prognosis and a preference might be different. What's an outcome? What happened? All right, so it's this long thing. Here's what we think will happen. I'm not sure that I'm good with that yet, but I'm going to have to get used to it. And then what's the outcome? And at what cost? At what risk? I'm going to take you through the study because it raises some profound social, ethical, moral, and even spiritual realities in our lives. Here's what they did. They took 9,100 or so patients and basically split them into four groups. They actually split this group into two waves. 4,500 people were studied in the what's called the controlled version of the experiment, and then they had the experimental component of the project later on. First thing they did is they took 4,500 or so people that were in teaching hospitals, five teaching hospitals like UMC at different parts of the country, and they simply watched them. They watched them die. They took careful notes of what was, chart notes and things like that, how long it took for the end of life process that they were undergoing to occur, and what was happening in the meantime. Now, you need to know that these 4,500 people were not college kids who'd come to hospitals after being injured in a car accident. These were people that were, on average, more or less, 65 years old, which seemed a lot older 20 years ago than it does now. I'll be 65 on my next birthday. 44% female, a little bit underrepresented for women, a little bit overrepresented for African Americans at 15%, and here are the two important numbers up there. 26% of the 4,500 people in the first wave of the study died during this admission to the hospital. 47% died within 6 months. So we've got, this is what we've got from that chart. We have an aging population with a 50-50 chance of living 6 months. These are people who are in the end stages of their lives. They have metastatic cancer. They have COPD. They have kidney failure. They have a progressive and largely predictable end of life on the way. And everybody knows it. Everybody knows it. They know it. Their family knows it. The doctor knows it. So the prognosis is pretty simple. You got a coin flip's chance of living 6 months. Okay? Not what you'd prefer to hear. Not uncommon. So the question is, what about preferences and outcomes? We know what the prognosis is. An aging population with a coin flip's chance of living 6 months. And it is no secret. Nobody's hiding this information. Everybody knows it. Well, one of the things that you might think would come up was whether or not to introduce CPR. Now, I think they've got a different term for that. I think it's called AND instead of CPR. CPR is cardiopulmonary resuscitation, which is the physical act of trying to restart a heart with machines and drugs and hands. AND stands for allow natural death. That's the new way of saying this. But these are actually the slides that Joanne Lynn brought to present to us 23 years ago, and I've had them ever since, and was lucky to get them. What this chart says is that, remember again, 65 on average, 50-50 chance to live in 6 months, you would think the discussion would come up that if the heart stops, what do? More often than about a third of the time. In only one-third of the cases did the question even come up. And you need to know that the default in American hospitals, the default in American ambulances, is to start CPR. Doesn't matter what else is going on. The default, unless told otherwise, if a heart stops, we move heaven and earth to try to restart it. Fair enough? So, you would think that when there's a coin flip's chance of even living 6 months, that discussion would be more relevant. But what they learned in the original part of the study is that this only came up a third of the time. So 2/3 of the time, nobody even talked about it. When it came up, the doctor understood the patient's preference to forgo CPR, which is usually what happens when it comes up in a situation like that. You know what? If it stops, I'd be just as well off, you know, because there are things that are worse than death. And it's true. 36 years in the ministry has taught me that in Technicolor. In the first part of the study, in the 1 out of 3 instances where the question came up, the doctor only understood the patient's preference to forgo CPR half the time. The other half the time, the doctor just either didn't get the message or needed to be persuaded or in some way or another didn't write the order. So it only comes up a third of the time, and when it comes up, it only gets understood half the time. And when it gets understood, the DNR, or now the AND order, was written within 2 days of the patient's death, which meant for several weeks, maybe, the patient lived under threat of, and I don't know if you've ever witnessed a code in a hospital. I've been a hospital chaplain. I've been in many hospitals where this has occurred. It is chaos. People are running in, shouting, procedures are being implemented, there may be blood, you know. And if you're 86 and haven't been breathing well for 5 years, and somehow or other you've fallen through the cracks, and they do this to you, everybody knows this is nuts. And let me give you the punchline to this before we even get any further. This study was designed to be a wake-up call to hospitals. And I will tell you that they woke up. We'll get to that in a little bit. But the point is, I have this vision when I see this slide of this subject pool of people 65-ish with a 50-50 chance of living 6 months who have expressed a preference not to have their heart restarted if it stops, wondering, has he written it? Has she done it? Is it there? Ah, it's safe to go now. Most of the time, they get written within 2 days of the patient's death. And I wonder if someone in this condition, well, I don't wonder. I've talked to many, many people over the years in this condition. And a lot of them, because of data like this, have said early on, don't even think about it. It's not safe to die for a lot of people unless they've had some control and autonomy and had their preference expressed and had that happen. Here's another one. They wanted to know what that previous time before the DNR was written was like. I love the way researchers present this stuff. 10 or more undesirable days, roughly a third, lived for 10 or more undesirable days. It's May 1st. So let's talk about April 20th, let's say. I don't know what was going on April 20th. Can you even remember? You know, 10 days ago, a week and a half? It would have been a week ago Sunday or so, right? I can't remember what I had for breakfast. You know, French toast. I lied. Severe pain. Half the people in this study died while they were in severe pain. Now, a lot of that has to do with worrying about prescribing prescription drugs. And the opioid crisis has made this even more prominent. I mean, that's a whole other issue. But the point is this. What is severe pain? Well, these days it's on the list of first five questions they ask you when you go to a doctor for pretty much any reason. Are you in any pain? Yes or no? Yes. On a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being modest and manageable to 10 being the worst pain I've ever felt, what is it? 10, the worst pain I've ever felt. That's severe pain. How might that feel? What might that feel like? Who's ever had a broken bone? One broken bone. Broke a rib, broke a finger, broke a wrist, broke a leg. Hurts like the devil, doesn't it? I mean, just one? New biology walks. How many bones are there in the human body? 206. Okay. A person who's lung cancer or breast cancer or liver cancer has metastasized to the bone will, not unusually, put lesions, which are the same as holes and cracks, in 25% of your bones. What's 25% of 206-ish? 50? Yeah. Can you imagine having the pain of one fracture times 50? Oh, and by the way, the drugs they're giving you to dull that, the opioids, constipate you? Get the idea? So that's how they learned we die. That's how they learned that CPR is not routinely discussed. When it's discussed, it's widely misunderstood. When it's understood, it doesn't get implemented till the last minute, and people are suffering. That make sense? That's the upshot of the first observational phase of the study. They spent about a third of the money just watching people. Then they intervened. They did an intervention on the hospitals and the hospital staff, and then they watched another 4,500 people die under the same conditions and wanted to know what was the result of our intervention. Well, this is where they spent most of the money. They gave the patients overly specific information on the prognosis. You know, that's the survival over the next 6 month piece. Look me in the eye, take my hand, and listen carefully. This is the deal. You get it? You sure? You got it? Does he get it? Does she understand? That kind of stuff. In a much more caring and gentle way, right? But they trained professional communicators, nurses and others, how to communicate this information. I mean, you can be very good at communicating and terrible at communicating this. Well, they trained people and had them practice and did role plays and everything you can possibly think of with $25 million to do it to try to make sure this information was given and understood. And then, what now? And I'll sit here and listen to you as long as you want. We want to know what you prefer. We want to know what you'd like to have happen. They also told the hospitals, you know, this is what we found in the first wave of the study, and you suck at this, essentially. And then they said it in a good Christian way. And all this, they did everything nearly $25 million could do to get the patient's preferences expressed, understood, and implemented earlier, and in some way to ameliorate or make some comfort care, make their last days more comfortable. So they did this for 2 years. And then they published their results. This is the impact of the intervention. There's only one word on that slide that matters at all. It is the last word on the sentence that begins phase two intervention. What happened? What happened? What did they do with the $25 million in effect? Nothing. Might as well pour it down the drain. It did not enhance communication. It didn't improve physicians' understandings of preferences, get the DNR written earlier, reduce time spent in undesirable or severe pain. What they spent $25 million learning is that, especially in America and especially in teaching hospitals, this is a freight train to avoid, resist, and thwart death, even if it means that the not dead are in a state of existence, not living. Let me just take a little side digression here. What does this mean? It means that there are people, or at least certainly there are people in this study, that were well beyond what I think the very best definition I've ever heard of as to when life should end. I had a cat for 17 years. And you know what happens to cats. You get to the point where you know they're in trouble. You know they've got things that are wrong with them. And I had a conversation with my vet, and I said, well, how do you know? How do you know when it's time to give them rest? And this is the best answer I've heard before or since, and I've been on clinical ethics committees in hospitals for 15 years. I've studied this stuff. He said, it's time to give them rest when they stop having fun. When they stop having fun. Now, you can be quite ill and even in pain and still have some fun. I mean, Skyping with your grandkids, that can be fun. But when even that stops being fun, well, we really can't put people out of their misery. We do it for our cats, you know. And in many ways, a Martian ethicist or a Martian simply decent creature would say you treat your cats better than you do your people. And, you know, I don't want to get into the whole debate, but there are a few states in America now that have facilitated a fairly careful and reasonably rigorous process of being able to obtain a lethal dose of prescription barbiturates. And that's kind of a social movement that's picked up based on this. You know, Dr. Kevorkian was the caricature of this, you know. But he sort of put it in our faces, saying, you know what, as long as the numbers look like this, we ought to think about this. Well, as a result of this study, now 20-some years later, it is now the order of the day for the intake process to a hospital, certainly, and maybe even a trip to your local doctor's office, for the question to be asked, do you have an advance directive? Now, what's an advance directive? An advance directive is something that you write in advance of the need to express your preferences. It goes to that preference piece of the support study. What do you want to have happen if things go south? Now, the intriguing piece on this is do not resuscitate means you just don't do one thing. Allow natural death has some room in there to do other things. Not just don't do this, but do this instead. Mozart, gin, my cat, and at least someone who loves me anyway. I want all four of that 24/7. It's not asking a lot, is it? They can rotate. I've got more than three people in their lives who love me that much. I mean, I'm lucky. I mean, I have one that would be the... Never mind. In other words, that's what I want. And I wrote it down. And it's called The Living Will. And I actually have a copy of it in the briefcase I usually carry when I travel. All right, that's... It was weird to do that. We did it at the same time we wrote the will. You know, what do we want with whatever money we don't spend? And that might not be very much. My retirement plan is to bounce the last check I ever write. Wouldn't that be great? Sorry. That's not true. But I have that. And then they say, is it on file? You know? Well, over the course of the last couple, 3 years, we've had some medical care where I actually put a copy of it in my phone, you know, just because they wanted it there. They'll ask for it. They'll want to see it, whether they think you need it or not, because you never know what'll happen. I mean, any surgery has risks. But anyway. So you need, if you want to try to get off this freight train, you need, or somebody you love would need, actually two things. One is with the way of advance directives. There are two advance directives that typically come into play here. One is, as I say, the living will, which expresses your preference. The other is it's a document called Durable Power of Attorney for Healthcare. That gives someone the absolute right to decide what to do on your behalf. So, you know, obviously my wife and I are each other's power of attorney in that instance, and the backup is my youngest stepdaughter. And when we told her that, she said, you mean I can unplug you? I said, well, yeah, I guess so. You know, and then plug me back in, see if that helps. It works for my laptop. The only way to get through a discussion like this is to make light of it, especially if you've lost someone important to you just in the last year or two. It's a way of expressing a preference and at least understanding that you can't avoid this, So now that you know that, what decisions would you like to make? You know, and I had one, and I can't remember what stories I tell you because I just, my ADHD is worse than anybody else's. But anyway, I had a conversation with someone who is the grandson and the next of kin, which is interesting. This 90-year-old woman that I love dearly, that was in my church for a long time, and her grandson, because her grandson was her next of kin. She had lost two sons. Most people don't outlive their kids, and she'd outlived both of them and her husband. So her grandson is, he's 30-ish at this point. And she had, you know, she smoked all of her life and had COPD, and at 90, she was struggling in the hospital. And it was one of those sort of palliative care units. It was, the light was quiet and there was music going, and it was a, you know, as pleasant as it can be in a situation like that. And they said, well, do you want us to put the breathing tube in? Because we can help her breathe. Because if we don't, she's going to stop breathing fairly soon. And that will give her discomfort unless we make her more comfortable, which means giving her more morphine, which actually it hastens the stopping of breathing. Because one of the side effects of opioids is that they suppress the respiratory drive. And so we're having this discussion, right? And it's just the two of us. He's her next of kin, and I'm the minister. And I don't know where this came from, through my head and out of my mouth, but it's one of the wisest things I've ever said, and I take no credit for it. I was taking dictation, and I don't know from where. But what I said was this. I said, you never have to unplug a machine you never plug in. And it was inevitable that they would have to unplug that machine at some point, sooner than later. You never have to unplug a machine you never plug in. And that's the result of this study. The Joint Commission for the Accreditation of Healthcare Associations, the organization that when there's a JACO inspection, everything in a hospital stops except this, has now put a metric in. Do you have a process for end-of-life decision-making? Do you require advanced directives, or at least inquire about them regularly? Do you require the inquiry about advanced directives? Let's put it that way. And there's this whole thing. And I spent 15 years on UMC's Medical Ethics Committee designing the profile at UMC to satisfy this accreditation metric. So the world has changed. And it cost $25 million to know that at least in 1990, we sucked at this. Now we suck a little bit less. The hospice movement has taken off. And hospice medical directors have more latitude with prescribing pain medication than others. You know, there's that whole piece of this. And I really think that we have changed the world in many respects on this. Forcing people, and this is part of why it's in this presentation, forcing people even in their 20-ishness to at least acknowledge that this is in play. Now, I am certain, and I don't need a show of hands on this, that you have people in your life for whom this is a relevant discussion. You know, parents worried about grandparents or some such thing. And, you know, your parents are nudging into the age where most people start writing wills, and that's a vivid little exercise, you know, to put in two dimensions the two-dimensional value of your life, you know. And all of the stuff we have, it's valued in more than two dimensions, let's put it that way. My point here is this. This is a kind of reality check, and yet it's also part of what it means to be a critical thinking, gentle, generous person, is to not absorb and obsess, but acknowledge with inevitable reality that everything that lives at one point stops living. And okay, that's the prognosis. The death rate for human beings is 100%. Life starts, it ends, and you have the time in between. And that's what you get to decide to do with. And then, you know, part of that decision-making process is to figure out to what extent you might want to have some say over how it ends. And, you know, you may not. I mean, I'm getting on 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm getting on 8 airplanes in the next 4 days, 6 days. Two hop trips, forth and back. I don't know what's going to happen, you know. But if you obsess about that, you'd never go anywhere. And we already promised the grandkid we're taking him to D.C. You know, you get the idea. And oddly enough, you know, that's another thing that happens to you when you start leaning on 65, is you decide, you know what? I got an extra day of class I got to cover. They're not going to hate it if I give them an optional movie, right? Am I right about that? I'd like to say I'm going on a. I'd like to say I'm going on an academic. I'm taking a kid, who we don't see more than 3 or 4 times a year, on a trip that I hope he'll remember his whole life, because I expect that he will outlive me, you know, etc. Those are the kinds of questions that generate in you what I think makes life worth it. Right. We have time in between to decide. All right. Now, I have one more bit that I want to give you, but I want to also give you the Greg Abbott direction. So let's just get through all that, because the last thing I want to say, I don't want to be lost in the shuffle of Greg Abbott. So just get ready for Greg Abbott Day. It is May 1st, and put your name on a sheet of paper. Okay, we good? You got your name on a sheet of paper, May 1st? I just want you to listen to my last 2 minutes. Our lives began, and we know exactly when that was. I actually know it was at 9:47 in the evening on the date of my birth in the year. I don't know when it will end, but we have time in between. So the question is, what do you want to do with the in-between time? Here's what I suggest you do with it. I suggest you change the world. Yeah, how am I going to do that? Funny you ask, I'll tell you. But first, a story. Took a final exam in high school. It was a physics exam. And it had a story problem. I'm embellishing the story problem because that's what I do. I embellish stories. But the problem essentially was this. A guy gets up to go fishing one sunny spring morning, packs his gear, rows his boat into the middle of an idyllic lake, watches the sunrise, pours himself a cup of coffee. Got the mind picture? All by himself. Casts his line and in fairly short order, somewhat oddly, gets a strike. And in the course of reeling in the fish, the coffee spills into the lake. Now, the math problem, the arithmetic problem, essentially, went like this. Here's the volume of the lake. Here's the volume of the cup. Here's the temperature of the lake. Here's the temperature of the coffee. And we'll make the impossible assumption that the coffee is equally mixed throughout the lake. And the final exam question was, by how many degrees, or fractions thereof, does the lake temperature go up if a cup of coffee is spilled in it? And of course, the answer on the test is 2.5 times 10 to the minus I don't know what degree. But here's what I've never forgotten about that story problem. That if you extend the logic of the question to human life, if you have a sensitive enough device to measure it, you could detect the impact of a human life, analogous to detecting the rise in a lake temperature through the spilling into it of a cup of coffee. Get the idea? Well, the question is, what's the device? What is the measuring device that detects the impact of a human life? Well, I've thought about this for a long time, and I have an answer for you. Whether it's the answer, you figure it out. The measuring device is this. It is compassion. Now, I'm going to tell you what compassion isn't first. It's not you know, off to the side here looking at somebody's sad, sorry life and going, that's a sad, sorry life. That's pity. And pity hurts. Compassion, rather, is the observation of a sad, sorry life, yours or somebody else's. And on the basis of that observation, being 100% certain that it could happen to you. There's nothing that can happen to any human being that couldn't happen to you, including being a war refugee, up to and including everything you see anywhere, because you cannot predict the convergence of time and circumstance. All you have to do is know that there's nothing that can happen to anyone that is impossible to happen to you. Even if what's happening to someone else is a result of their own terrible decision making. Is there anybody in this room that would argue that you and me are capable, because we have the evidence from our own lives, of terrible decision making? Right? Yeah. I think what compassion does, and here's how it changes the world. It makes you more generous, emotionally and materially. It makes you more tolerant, because you can imagine walking in someone else's shoes. And it makes you more honest, because you just don't have to BS yourself. Compassion changes the world, and that's your job in between. For Greg Abbott, write the first line or two of your own obituary. He was, she was, what? Thank you very much.